So water poverty, I mean, according to the UN, because of seasonal cycles, somewhere around 2 billion people live in water poverty throughout the year. In the Central African Republic, I know that it is killing one out of five children before they reach their fifth birthday because of waterborne illness. That water kills, dirty water kills more people than war and violence does completely throughout Africa.
You're listening to the 95 Podcast from the team at 95 Network, where we host conversations specifically designed to support leaders in small and mid-sized churches.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome back to the 95 Podcast. This is Dale Sellers, Executive Director at 95 Network. Got another great guest with me today. Connected through Jason Hamrick, a good friend of ours, recently reached out with an email and introduced me to Weston, who is on with us today. And then as it worked out, we were going to have an introductory call, and he came to my hometown. So we had breakfast at one of the best places in Greenville, South Carolina, called Stacks Omega. And he's still thinking about it weeks later.
I am, man. It was good.
So Weston Williams, welcome to the 95 Podcast.
Well, thanks, Dale. This is fun. I enjoy it. Enjoyed getting to know you a little bit at Stacks Omega. And Greenville is a truly beautiful town. Big fan. Big fan of that whole area.
I encouraged you. I said, man, you got to check out downtown. And then I touched base with you afterwards and just, was it nice? And you said it lived up to the hype. So that was good.
It did. And then we went to Lewis Barbecue, which I would put that on the list of must-sees. So big fan.
Well, Lewis the barbecue place just came, and, you know, South Carolina and North Carolina, all these areas, you know, they're all barbecue snobs anyway. But Lewis Barbecue is a really great place. But anyway, today I wanted to take a moment. You've made a ministry transition recently, and we'll talk more about that later, about what you're doing now and what we want to introduce our listeners to. But first of all, I just want to hear your story. Where are you from?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in California in the Fresno area. That's where my family's from. And my wife is actually from Southern California, and independent of each other, not knowing each other. By the time we were both in high school, we moved to Denver and met each other there. And she's been my steady date ever since then. I felt a call into ministry kind of early, kind of young, and went to Bible college, went to seminary. And then ended up in Southern California in a little inner city church that they said they were 100. They were probably 80 on a good Easter, you know. But if you count everybody that walks through the parking lot or, you know, all the pregnant women twice, you know, you might get there. So, we did ministry there. I was super young. I was in seminary doing ministry in this inner city community. And, you know, God really, I think, taught us a lot. I figured out real quick I didn't know what I was doing, and I was able to reach out to some surrounding pastors and mentors. And I would say, you know, I probably learned more in ministry than I did in seminary through the coaching and mentoring of people around me who were willing to give me some time. And that ministry, you know, was man, there's a lot of great things we could celebrate about it, but it was difficult. And towards the end of this little church had just, you know, it kind of the white flight, you know, phenomenon that happens in a lot of cities, you know, had happened where you've got, you know, a military base closed down, a lot of depression, economic depression came in. And eventually one of our elders ended up being murdered as he was trying to save his wife's purse.
Oh, my goodness.
And that just kind of crushed the spirit of the church. And after that, you know, I kind of presided over them closing the church. And then that sent me on a quest to look for a new place to minister.
And so let me ask you this question. Was this your first church?
Yeah. Yeah, that's my
first thing was to a full-time pastor there?
Well, I started as the youth pastor. Okay, I did youth and associate. Okay. Mm-hmm. But about a year and a half into this thing, our senior minister had a family crisis that precipitated him needing to leave. And so he left. And nobody really wanted to come into this place. And they said, well, here, you've got some seminary education. You ought to fit the bill. And, you know, I was young and dumb enough to think that, you know, maybe I could.
Now, how old are you this time?
Oh, man, 22, 23.
Yeah, early 20s. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, early 20s. Oh yeah, it was.
Hey, by the way, been there, done that.
Right. Well, it's not an uncommon tale, but yeah, it was like just kind of thrown into this mix. And I mean, the median age was probably 75. I mean, that's how old this church was.
When was this? Was this in the '80s?
Oh, no. This is the early 2000s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's the early 2000s, man. So
your first church, you're in your early 20s and you're pastoring people who could be your great grandparents.
Yes. Yes. One of my most fond memories is this sweet little lady. She looked at me. Her husband had to be 8 feet tall when she was 3 feet tall. And she looked at me and she said, "We've run people like you out of this place before." And, you know, that was the welcoming committee.
Was that to say that we want you to stay, or we want you to go ahead and prepare your, not unpack your bags?
Yeah. Don't unpack your bags. Don't get too comfortable. But you know what? She and I became friends. My motto at this point, I think, had just been to outlove and outlast. And, and it worked, you know, I won her over. And, we had a really good relationship by the time everything kind of came to an end there.
So what was the biggest thing, if you look back at that, what was the biggest thing that you just felt like, man, I have no clue? Because you said you reached out to mentors and friends. What was like the biggest thing that just like you became aware, I don't know anything about this part of pastoring?
I think a lot of it was just kind of, in the beginning of that, was just kind of leading a group of people who, you know, we all say, this is the direction we want to go. I think everybody said, we want to reach the neighborhood. You know, we want to get connected with people. And so we agree on the end goal. Mm-hmm. But then when we realize the next step is to, you know, provide donuts, or it's to open the building, or, you know, do any of these number of things, change music just a little bit, maybe. And then we're like, oh, no, we don't want to do any of that.
No, we want to reach everybody. We just don't want to change.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think trying to find, you know, methods and ways and approaches to kind of help people see, kind of, I guess the word for that people use is vision casting, and trying to help people buy into that. I think that was the thing that was the hardest, was just kind of keeping this, you know, this group of people together, because we did have a common cause and love, but we disagreed radically on many things. So. Yeah.
That's, well, I admire you that you even made it through to the end of it, of the church.
Well, yeah, it was, I don't know. What I didn't have for in knowledge, I made up for in zeal, you know,
they probably said things like, our preacher, he's not too smart, but he works real hard.
Yeah, he works hard and he loves us. I think they would say he loves us well. At least I would hope that's what they would say.
Well, honestly, so. that's usually the bridge that you have to cross if you're going to lead anybody anywhere. If they know you love them, they can work through some of that other stuff. So you're there, that church closes, and now what happens?
Well, then I didn't want to be a preacher. I realized I needed to learn a bit, so I started looking for adult ed ministries. That's what I wanted to do. That wasn't in vogue at the time. It still isn't. So I found a position out here in Bowling Green, Kentucky, which is where I'm at now. And they hired me sort of as a hybrid role of involvement. So I was doing small groups and youth ministry here. And that was great. Senior minister and I got along really well. And you know, the church has been very warm and welcoming to us. And then after about, 2.5 years, senior minister here left. And at that point, I was thinking I wanted to get back into preaching ministry, and had been applying to jobs out west, which is where I'm from. And then when he left, I thought, maybe we'll stick around and see how this goes. The church knows me well. They know what I'm good at. They know what I'm not good at. So, you know, they'll know real quick if it's a good fit or not. And you know, they may or may not be interested, but they were, and they hired me, and I've been the preaching minister in Bowling Green for 15 years. So I've been here at the church for about 17 years total. Wow. And, it's been a great experience. We've done a lot of things I'm really proud of. And then I just 3 months ago, stepped down from that position. I'm helping them in the interim. So it's been a really, you know, amiable transition. I've been continuing to preach while they've launched their search. And so, you know, it's been really good. It's
when we talked at breakfast that day, you made a comment I want to come back to. But before I do, something else popped in my head. So how does a guy from California, how did you find this church in Bowling Green? Because I'm sure listeners would like to know, how did you end up there?
Sure. So I'm part of the Independent Christian Churches, the used to be the North American Christian Church group. And so all of our churches post jobs at like-minded Bible colleges and seminaries. And so I just kept kind of applying out. You know, at that point in time, I kind of felt broken and defeated because this church had closed. And, it was
one of those denominations too, one of those independent. Yeah. Okay. All right. Good.
Yeah. And so that's just how I found it. I just kind of kept moving my circle out. My wife and I both kind of have an adventurous spirit. We were just, I don't know, we've never moved closer to family. Not that we don't like our family. We always said, we've never been here. This would be fun. Let's go give this a shot. So, Kentucky seemed like an adventure. I thought it'd be a 5-year plan. But now, you know, we're into 20 years. So about
kind of settling there, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I just thought it was interesting. I wanted to find out how a guy from California found a church in Kentucky. So when you and I were talking for breakfast that day, you talked about that you have resigned the church, and currently, as you mentioned, you're the intern of your own church. But how did that resignation come about? Because I thought that was very interesting what you told me.
Yeah. So like every other pastor in America, I mean, we went through, you know, a divisive, you know, election, and then we had COVID. Prior to that, we had had a building campaign. So in 2016, we had a building campaign, you know, and then we had, you know, the election that we all went through, and then we had COVID. And so, I mean, there was a lot of things that had happened at our church. And, you know, I'd started to feel a little tired about some things, but I felt like I was, you know, not in a burnout place, but just kind of in a sense of like, you know, I need a little bit of time. And so I'd scheduled a sabbatical for this year. But part of this, we were looking for a youth minister for about a year. And through that year period of time, my vision for the future of the church had faded. And I felt like I'd had a lot of my emotional house, you know, come in order. I mean, there's some places that were still tired and tender, but I just didn't have the crystal clear vision that I used to have for our church. You know, like I could wake up hungry and see what is the next step? Where are we going? You know, this is the direction. And so I started praying through that year, you know, God, would you increase my vision? Would you increase my passion? And that just didn't seem to be answered that way. And so then we hired a youth minister, a guy who's actually probably one of my best friends. And I thought, man, this is going to be the game changer. And as we get into it, you know, he gets hired, and I think, yeah, now that I'm not worried about this, you know, it'll change. And it didn't. And so I was out to breakfast with him and our worship minister, and they were just going a mile a minute with thoughts about the church and their passion and energy and excitement. And I thought to myself, this is exactly what our church needs, but I can't keep up with them. And I called my wife and I said, you know, I'm just kind of tired all over thinking about all of these things they're talking about, but it's right. And so I, you know, my prayer changed real quick. It was, Lord, increase my vision, you know, increase my passion right away, or I need you to open up a new door of opportunity for me to serve. Because I sensed that at some point in time, and maybe not that far away, I would be the one holding our church back. And I didn't want to be that. You know, I love our church. I'm proud of everything that we've done. You know, and so, you know, I think God sort of moved in a way that opened up this new position for me at Water for Good. And it's, you know, it's been a good transition for all of us, the church and myself and my family.
How old are you now?
I'm 42.
Okay, so you're 42 years old. You begin to recognize, man, my passion for this place is beginning to wane. But you would not describe, I don't think you describe yourself as reaching burnout. But you were on the path to burnout, I bet.
Oh yeah, I would say that's probably true. Yeah. I would say that's why we had a sabbatical scheduled for me. I just, as I was thinking about that sabbatical, I realized I think I'm going to come back still to the same set of problems and issues. I don't think a sabbatical is going to solve this for me. I think it's a deeper issue. And I had to come to this belief that if God had sort of taken the vision for the future of the church from me, it was because he was giving it to somebody else. And I needed to allow that person to come in, whoever they end up being.
Well, I told you at breakfast that day, I said, you know, Weston, you're the first guy that I've personally ever sat down with who actually told me that. Because and I talked about, in chapter 9 of my book, where we talk about the sweet spot, I talk about how that when you're in your sweet spot, if you stay in your sweet spot too long, it can become a sour spot because, you ripen and, there's a fine line between being too ripe and getting rotten. I think we call rotten burnout now, but I was impressed to meet someone who actually goes, my vision is not here for the future. And I think the main reason that we pastors hold on too long is just the financial security of it all. You didn't have a plan B when you began to recognize this, did you?
No, I didn't. I didn't have a plan B. I mean, cause I still love the church, and I wanted to work with the church on some, my hope was that I could find something that would empower churches to work on some of the bigger vision pieces, some of the bigger projects that always gave me so much life. And so I was hoping I could find something like that, but I had no sense of guarantee. And I did know at that time, and I would say it's still true. I didn't have another church in me. Could that change in the future? Sure. But I didn't have one. I don't have one in me right now.
Would you say at your age, because this is a normal thing, you are in midlife? Or like a midlife crisis time or reflecting time? Because that happens to us, and because of your sure. age, that's why I asked that question.
Yeah, I don't feel like I have had seasons of what we might term existential crisis. Mm-hmm. And there were seasons in ministry where I wanted to quit, but I didn't, largely because I felt like I wasn't going to leave the church in better shape than when I found it. And so when this season kind of came and that vision faded for me, I stopped and took assessment. I realized, there's no reason for me to quit. This church has never been healthier. It's never been in better shape, so in many ways it's the sense of saying, we need to just kind of hand this off to the next person. As I reflected on this, maybe kind of more to your question, in some ways, and I don't think too much about all this, but in some ways I feel a little bit like David, who wanted to build the temple for God. Mm-hmm. And God says, no, you're not the guy, your hands have shed too much blood. Now I haven't killed anybody, but
as far as physically, right?
As far as physically. Yeah. I've never killed anybody, but we have faced a lot of battles. I mean, our church here in Bowling Green was founded in 1963. And so, it's an older church. And with that, there was a lot of kind of institutional changes that needed to be made. And I think in some ways, as I looked at the future, I thought, there's really not another battle here for me to fight. And the idea of just maintaining and being the sheriff of Mayberry, I don't know that I want that. If I had to pick anything, I might say that was kind of part of that for me. So
this is just a fascinating conversation to me. I've not had it with any other pastor, because typically, as I said, either one, they sometimes you'll create a fight because you need one, and then you end up getting run off, or else you'll do everything you can to stay there because of the security of it all. But it makes me think of Tony Morgan at the Unstuck Group has done like a bell-shaped mm-hmm. curve of the life cycle of a church. And one of the things I found fascinating, Tony says, every church starts with a launch, and then it has like what you call momentum growth, where it just grows because it's new. Then you have this place where you get to a level of what you have to have called strategic growth, because you have to add a pastor, you have to add a staff, you have to, administrator, whatever. But the goal is to get to sustained health at the top of the curve. And yep. then Tony talks about when you come back down the curve, the first thing you run into is the maintenance phase, and then the preservation mode, and then you go to life support. Tony said, and I just didn't recognize this, but it makes so much sense to me. So many churches, when they get to the maintenance phase, actually feels like the most successful season of the church. They've got the buildings built, most usually they're out of debt, they've got the most volunteers, the most money coming in, everything seems to be going the way it needs to be going. But what happens is everybody kind of gets satisfied and the focus turns inward. Yep. And, you know, your church probably, you know, is at the maintenance stage, but by you making this choice and they bring in someone new, they'll go, they can go back to sustained health. And the point of all this is, Tony says, you know, that from, you can go back up to sustained health from maintenance, but once you get into preservation and life support, you can't go back up again. And so I feel good for one, for you, because I think it's opened up a new door for you that we'll talk about in a second. But I also feel good for this church because you didn't stay too long.
I think the best bit of ministry advice I got was from a guy who said, it was in a seminar for long pastorates, which was phenomenal. But he said, you know, you should always leave while they're still sad to see you go. Yeah. And, you know, and I thought about that and I thought, you know what? This is that time. You know, I think if I stayed longer, they would be glad to welcome me and love me. And I could probably fake it for a long time. But, you know, at some point in time, you know, you get found out. And, well,
you would be empty on the inside too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It just, that sustaining peace. Yeah. And I wasn't interested in that. So yeah, it kind of led me to search for things. And I thought, you know, I thought I'd be looking for something for a long time. I thought I'd be still looking for something at this point. So it all happened rather quickly.
Well, yeah, but what happens is when you're listening to the Lord and following his steps for your life, he already had a plan. And so we're going to dive into that in just a second. You know, the last part of what I talk about when I talk about the sweet spot is, you know, I learned that sometimes when you're functioning and you're doing great in your sweet spot, God's got an unknown sweet spot for you that you never know about until you've been faithful in the one you've been in. And I think this transition that you've made is a great example for that. So let's do this. Let's take a quick break. And then we come back. I want to talk about what you're transitioning to and just let folks know about it. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Now, I'm willing to bet this week you've gone to a business's website. And I feel safe saying this because it's widely known that every successful business, no matter how big or small, has a strategic online plan. At the 95 Network, we believe that every church, no matter how big or small, must also have a strategic online plan. Now, we know that this can be overwhelming to most pastors, but have no fear, we're here to help. Jesse's our digital discipleship coach. He can help you have a plan of what and when to post online. He can even help you use your Sunday message throughout the week to get more mileage out of that message. Let the 95 Network help you and your church have a great online presence. Now, to get more information on how to contact Jesse or find anything else about the 95 Network, please go to 95network.org.
Well, we're back here with Weston talking through transition in ministry. And so you pastored the church, you began to recognize, you know what, I just don't have a vision for the future. And staff is good. The church is good. The location's good. The facilities are good. And you're like, you know what? I think it's time for me to head on. So you make that decision. So how did you reveal it? Did you leak it out? How did you go about letting the church know you were going to transition out?
Well, I'm still of the old school that you don't leave a job until you have one. I think my church would have been understanding if I had told them in advance, but I really didn't know how long it was going to take me. And I knew once I told them that, you know, it would start a clock instantly on my, you know, my time at the congregation.
That comment you just made was worth the whole podcast. Pastors, if you're in a bad situation, do not quit. If you can hold on till you got something else to do, even if it's get you a job at Chick-fil-A or Home Depot, but don't just jump out there. You know, there's this mistake that we make, called taking a leap of faith. And I've found that when you take a leap of faith, you meet the crash of reality. So that was great advice, man. Great advice.
Yeah. So I just started looking, my wife and I, you know, we started looking at, and I was, you know, I was praying about it. I was looking at different places, and I'd set up a job alert that was, you know, any job that had the word church and the word remote in it. Cause I didn't want to move my family. I got kids, high school, junior high age, mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to kind of stay here if possible. And so I thought, you know, how long is it going to take to find a remote church job that doesn't require me to travel, you know, 100 days, you know, a month. And so, I don't know, about a week or two after that, I see this position open up at Water for Good for church relations. You know, so it kind of helped me, you know, with that idea of trying to help churches with this bigger vision piece, because we're trying to network churches to combat water poverty in the Central African Republic. And I thought, you know, this would be a really cool job. I like it. And got into some interviews. The staff culture at Water for Good is great. And really, it just really felt good. Every conversation, every interview we had. And so finally they offered me a job. And then I went to our board of elders and I said, hey, this has happened. Kind of told them the story. And at first, I think they were trying to talk me out of it. And they realized, I'd kind of made up my mind. And so then after that, we released that to the church 2 weeks later. I told the staff before that. And then because, I was able to stay in town and Water for Good was great to be kind of kind and patient to our church. They didn't mind that I stayed to preach. And so I've been preaching about every Sunday since my resignation. I've had, 3 or 4 Sundays out of the pulpit. And then my family and I were actually going to be leaving in the middle of June to head up to New York for an extended time off. I'm actually going to be the summer pastor at a church up there.
I saw that on Facebook. Moose something. Big Moose.
Big Moose.
What is Big Moose?
It is, it's a community in the Adirondack Mountains where, folks just come in for the summer. There's a few year round residents. I shouldn't say they only come for summer. There's just a handful of year round residents. And so they're kind of only open for the summer. The church opens usually Father's Day, closes somewhere mid September. And then that's it. The church is closed and they hire a summer pastor, to come and preach. And they've got a beautiful, parsonage. They call it the manse. I guess it's a Presbyterian word, for us to live in. And so my whole family, we're going to head up there and give the folks at Bowling Green some space from us for a little while.
I can hear all the listeners right now going, hey, I need to sign up for that.
Yeah. They've been really great. It's been a lot of fun. It's a sweet group of people. It's a sweet community. The last guy that had this position kept getting invited back summer after summer for 25 years. So
wow.
I'm gonna hope for the same longevity because it's a pretty magical place.
Yeah, that sounds cool because I do some stuff in that area. So it's a beautiful part of the country. So talk to us about Water for Good. Were you familiar with it before you started working there? Or did you learn about it as you were doing the job search?
No, I learned about it as I was doing the job search. Okay. And honestly, I knew of water poverty. I did not really understand water poverty until I started getting into this because I wanted to be passionate about what I was doing. I wanted to believe in the agency I was working with. I felt like that was where I was going to find a lot of fulfillment. And so, the more I looked into what Water for Good was doing, how they were doing it, looked into their financials and how they were, stewarding the resources that people were giving to them. I felt really great about the agency and I thought, man, this would just be a cool group of people to work with on an important mission. And so, I learned about them through my application.
I'd heard about water poverty. I think it was Bruce Wilkinson when he wrote Prayer of Jabez, because it was such a huge book and he had resources available. I think I remember him talking about planting wells in areas, which this isn't totally foreign American concept. So kind of talk to us about what the need is.
Yeah. So water poverty, according to the UN, because of seasonal cycles, somewhere around 2 billion people live in water poverty throughout the year. In the Central African Republic, there is not really an electrical grid throughout the country. In certain cities, there's different, a little more amenities. Water poverty is in the Central African Republic. I know that it is killing 1 out of 5 children before they reach their 5th birthday because of waterborne illness. That water kills, dirty water kills more people than war and violence does completely throughout Africa. And I would say the world as well. It's a real issue. And, here's the definition for water security, or if you're not living in water poverty, it's that you can collect clean water with less than, I believe it's an hour round trip journey. So, think about that. We put in a pump in a community of maybe 500 people. 500 people share a hand pump in some locations, and we would say that that's water security. That all these folks are able to share that, here in America, I would be concerned for us if 500 people had to share a hand pump. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's the case of a lot of folks, you know, throughout the world. And so, you know, when you put in one of these pumps in a community where people now can shave their, you know, water collection time down to 15 minutes, you know, 20 minutes, that's a game changer. That lets women, and girls, you know, maybe take on some financial things. 'Cause you know, they're, you know, like jobs, girls are able to go to school. There's so much that happens. It's a game changer, when a community gets water. So, yeah, that's what we do. We drill wells. We place them in places that, you know, have a need. We do these community assessments to know that. We put in two kinds. We put in a hand pump and then a solar system that can have like three tap stands. You know, like you would think of like a hose. Mm-hmm. That can take communities, very large communities, a couple thousand people even. And so we put these in. And then the thing that makes us a lot different from other places is we don't just drill wells, we maintain them. So when we put a well in, it comes onto our service system, our service plan, and we visit those about every 6 months. We check water quality. We're making sure that all the pieces and parts are working, and we don't just repair something if it's broken. We'll do preventative maintenance. So that way our pumps actually have somewhere north of 90%. I think last I saw was 96% uptime, where the industry standard, if you read, is somewhere around like 40% was the last thing that I had read. So that's the thing that I think makes Water for Good different is we hire local folks. You know, our entire team is nationals to the Central African Republic. They're maintaining their own water systems. It's kind of a game changer there. It's funny too, because you think of the economy of it. You know, jobs come, we're able to create some jobs, but jobs that you wouldn't think of, once these pumps get in these places, folks that run restaurants or little businesses, you know, they don't maybe want to wait in line. So some guy's got his Uber water business, you know, mm-hmm. where they pay him a little bit. He waits in line, gets the water, runs it to, you know, delivery service. So, you know, again, things that we don't think about, but as you see, you know, that basic resource of water come online in an accessible way, you know, it does transform the community in ways that, you know, we wouldn't even think about or imagine. But it's fun to watch and see and hear about.
So beyond planting the wells, what do you do beyond that? Do you share the gospel or do you tie it to it somehow? How do you guys go about doing that?
Yeah, so our founding story, I think, is kind of, it's really a response to the church. Our founder was a Grace Brethren Church missionary there. He was born in the country. He grew up there, came back for seminary, then returned, and has, you know, had an entire career there as a missionary. You know, there's some political upheaval. They had to leave. He comes back and sees that the church has just grown and exploded. They're planting their own churches. They're reaching new people. And he asked me, so, you know, what do you need from us Americans? And this pastor said, you know, listen, we don't need your help running church. We know how to do that. We have people in our congregation dying because we don't have water. Mm-hmm. And that really launched Jim kind of on this quest to sort of, you know, solve that problem. Yeah, there's a lot we could get into on this, but the short version of the story is he does end up with a drilling rig and two drilling lessons. And then he starts with just a team of local folks. And that's 20 years ago. And today, close to 1 million people drink our water. And, you know, I think that's a testimony of just our love for the church, for the people. You know, we're definitely a Christian agency. We own a radio station in the country, the only private radio station there. And there we are broadcasting gospel message. We're broadcasting health and hygiene tips. And so, yeah, that it's part of who we are, but we're not, you know, we put wells in places where, you know, it might be a Muslim community because mm-hmm. we believe that folks, you know, you don't have to just be Christian to deserve a drink of clean and safe water. And so we're putting those wells in wherever we can, motivated by the love of Christ. And it's interesting to see that, you know, as this does happen, you know, conversations naturally occur, you know, like, who are you? Why are you here? Why are you putting this well in? You know, there's a real practical piece, just showing our love in action. That's kind of really how we think about that.
And I'm assuming you raise most of your support here in the U.S.?
Yeah. Yeah. Most of our support is raised here in the U.S. You know, we're a 501c3, and so we work with different you know, groups, Charity Water, we've partnered with us. We've worked with other agencies, And then, yeah, we have a lot of church donors, and that's what I'm here is to kind of build up church partnerships, for this work. And it's, I don't know, it's an exciting thing. I know as a pastor, I was always looking for, you know, missions that we could celebrate as a church and kind of know what we had done. You know, it's one thing to, you know, raise $5,000 and send it off to some country and you go, you know, they're going to do some good work with that. And it's absolutely true. I'm sure they will. But for us, you know, we know that it costs us $5 to provide water to one person for a year. And so when you send that $5,000 to Water for Good, you can celebrate as a church, hey, we just gave 1,000 people water, you know, for the entire year. And it's something I think that, you know, church folks can understand easily, quickly, and celebrate. And so that's one of the things I think is kind of exciting about this is sort of a church partnership side.
How do churches partner with you? How does that go about since that's your role?
Yeah. So we've never had a church relations manager before, which is my title. And so we're actually developing really three ways for churches to partner with us. One is VBS. A lot of churches take on a missions, agency for VBS. Mm-hmm. And so we have VBS material. We're getting ready for, we've got content about ready for a Water for Good Sunday. So if you said, man, we want to kind of highlight water poverty, we want to raise money to make a difference in that. We'll actually have sort of a kit that we'll send to you. You know, most of it's electronic and, you know, you can just kind of open up and set a date on your calendar and we'll help you, you know, with the content we send you to promote that. So that way you can, you know, host a special offering for Water for Good and a Water for Good Sunday. We're working on a Lenten and water challenge where folks will give up drinking everything but water for either, you know, 7 days, a month, or the entire season of Lent, depending on how churches want to do this. And we'll be challenging folks to tabulate what are you saving by only drinking water and to make that as a donation to Water for Good and make a difference, in water poverty there. Another thing that we're working on, and we're kind of piloting this, is a year-end collaborative giving campaign where we would help a church, essentially host this year-end, you know, financial appeal that would benefit both Water for Good and the congregation. And that's based off of something we were doing at our church in Bowling Green, where at the year end, we would host a project that would be congregational, you know, focused in terms of like, maybe it's renovating, you know, our children's area or paying off a bus as we did 1 year. And then also a compassion project. And we've done that, I don't know, several years at Bowling Green and had really great success with it. As a matter of fact, kind of looking over the last, you know, several years of it, we were raising about 10% over and above our annual budget. And so it just came through, you know, good, clear communication at the, you know, at year end and letting people know, hey, you can give to this. And, you know, it makes a big difference. And so we're hoping to get some churches on board with that and love to help them with it.
So you actually will teach a church. I know one church that I attended every December, they do something called an overflow offering. And it usually has, you know, multiple points of what they're trying to accomplish, whether it's to pay off debt or, you know, launch a new campus or whatever. So basically that's kind of the same concept where it's a year-end giving campaign. And you come in and help structure that. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We would come in and we're actually, again, getting all this package right now. It'll be ready for this year. We'll have a system where you'll say, yeah, we want to do a collaborative campaign. If you take us on as your compassion partner, you know, I'll kind of help coach that church through that. We'll have everything from email templates to dates on the calendar. So, hey, start here. Send this out. Here's your postcard. Send everybody a giving statement at this point in time. Just real step by step. So if they've never done a year-end campaign, you know, we would actually kind of walk them through that whole process. And it's not complicated. It's not hard. There, you know, it does take a little bit of work. But, you know, the reward of that, the payoff for that in a congregation is really great, especially because you get to come into January saying, hey, you know, look what we did. You know, we started, you know, we did this at the end of last year. And so you get to begin the new year, not just with hope, but with, you know, some momentum in celebrating something that you've accomplished.
Now, the format is based on what you already have done, is what I'm hearing you say, when you were pastoring your church, correct?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, I started with just kind of a little map. And then the next year we used the map and we kind of tweaked it and said, you know, what went well, what didn't go well, how could we do this better? You know, and so over about 5 years, you know, we've just kind of got this perfected where I just kind of opened that file you know, every September, October, and just kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, hit play and, you know, allow that to kind of just run its course like we've done in the past. So yeah, it's something that's definitely worked in our setting. I've talked with other churches who do this type of thing. And it's definitely helped them. You know, it's one of those, if a church doesn't have anything like that, I think they're really, you know, they're leaving a lot of resources, out there in their church. I mean, there's a reason why NPR, PBS, the Humane Society, everybody's doing a year-end appeal. It's because people towards year-end are looking to make some final donations. And if the church doesn't have a compelling and clear case for why folks should give over and above what they've already given, then they're going to give that someplace else. And so for us, you know, making that, you know, that plea, that campaign, you know, push really sort of made a case for, you know, churches, you know, to make to their congregation saying, hey, listen, you know, this is why, you know, you ought to consider us in your year-end giving. And I know that it was, you know, we received a lot more than we would have had we not asked. I know church leaders are often, you know, concerned, like, you know, are you robbing from the general fund? And, you know, there may be a little bit of that that happens at year end. But we've all agreed in our leadership, looking at our financials, that this is by and large just unique giving that we would not have received or experienced otherwise.
Well, the main thing I wanted to pull up with there was, this is something you put into practice as a local pastor. It works. It's not necessarily tied to just, you know, everything you raise isn't going to Water for Good. You're actually helping churches get extra money for projects they do. But then you're just saying, hey, can you make us part of that? So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think the reason why you want a compassion partner for us in our church, when we would do it, we would always have a compassion project and a congregational project, because we found that people wanted to invest in both of those things. We had some people in our church who were like, we want to do a compassion project. And other people are like, no, we want to do a congregational project. So by sticking them together, we found that it seemed like we were able to connect with everybody in our church at some place sort of in their heart, you know, what motivated them. And so, you know, we would often give a third to a compassion project, and then we would keep like 2/3 for a congregational project. You know, we were real clear about that. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one of the things. It's very clear, you know, goals. We would tell the church exactly what was going to happen with our money. And then we would do exactly what we said we were going to do. That's always key. So, you know, yeah, that's kind of the system there. But that's why I think, you know, adopting a group like Water for Good, you know, that compassion project allows you to connect with everybody, even when you're also raising money, you know, for a church project.
Well, I know in our space, as we work with small and mid-sized churches, this is an area pastors struggle with tremendously, with raising money and how to go about doing it. And what I love about you and meeting you and hearing how you do this is, this is not some pie in the sky thing. It's something you've done. It's worked. There is a compassion project that they can be connected with Water for Good, but it's not just about that. You have a, if I can say, template of what worked. And so pastors, as you're listening today, and you're like, man, we need help in this arena. I haven't talked to a pastor lately yet in this, last seasons or since COVID, just hadn't talked with anyone who said, you know, we have so much money, I don't know what to do with it all. Just hadn't run into that. I mean, I've run into a lot of folks who are struggling, and it's difficult. And so I just feel like you'd be a great partner with them. As we move toward the end of the podcast, as you think about where you are today, what you've experienced, what you're doing now, and it sounds like you have vision for the future now as you're doing this new project. As you listen or understand, we have hundreds of small and mid-sized church leaders. As we come to the end of the podcast, what's a word of hope or encouragement or advice or wisdom you would share with our pastors today if you were sitting with them having a cup of coffee?
I think I would say two things. Actually, this morning I was reading through 2 Corinthians, and I was hit like a ton of bricks as Paul is sort of pleading with his church, going, you know, we've not closed our affection to you. You've closed your affection to us. You've closed your heart to us. And I thought, gosh, you know, ministry's always been hard. Even for the Apostle Paul, it's always been challenging. It's always been difficult. You know, I think we sometimes, you know, assume because we are trying to do good, people will always see that and understand our intentions. They don't, but we're not unique. And so I would, you know, I think I would say, you know, you're not alone in that. And the other thing I would say too, is kind of coming to the end of a ministry, you know, people feel nostalgic, and I've heard a lot of stories from folks, you know, that I've been surprised by. They've said to me, you know, man, you don't know this, but you've made such a difference, for me and my family. And so I guess I would also want to say to a pastor, you know, what you're doing matters, and it matters a lot. And you maybe don't know that, and it may be a while before you do, but what you're doing matters to somebody, and probably to a lot of people. And so be faithful. You know, Galatians says, don't become weary in doing what is good, because doing good can be wearisome sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hang in there. And, you know, along those lines, outlove and outlast. Yeah. You know, just outlove those people. And if you do, you will outlast those people that maybe are challenging in your ministry. So, yeah, you're not alone. And hang in there. Hang in there.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. This has been a really good podcast. I think it's been very practical with just where people are. And you've been very transparent and honest. And I think it's going to help a lot of folks. So thanks for your time today. And I will have connected in the show notes your email. I have the Water for Good website. And then if there's any other resources you want to make available, we will include those in the show notes as well. Thanks again for joining me, man.
Thanks for listening to the 95 Podcast. We look forward to sharing another episode with you next week. In the meantime, visit our website at 95network.org. The website is loaded with great resources created for small and mid-sized church leaders. Until next time, have a great week.